who have agreed to this venture, odd as it is. Mind you, most of the boys were at the bottom of their tankards when I cornered them last night, drinking off the pay from their last voyage. But they'll be sober as spinsters come morn, that I promise you. Seeing as 7 were all I could find, I'd like 4 more. 4 it is, said Roran. My men don't know much about sailing, but they're able-bodied and willing to learn. Clovis grunted. I usually take on a brace of new lads each trip anyway. So long as they follow orders, they'll do fine. Otherwise they'll get a belaying pin upside the head. Mark my words. As for guards, I'd like to have 9, 3 per boat. And they better not be as green as your sailors, or I won't budge from the dock, not for all the whisky in the world. Roran allowed himself a grim smile. Every man who rides with me has proved himself in battle many times over. And they all answer to you, eh, young Stronghammer? Said Clovis. He scratched his chin, eyeing Gedrick, Delwyn and the others who were new to Narda. How many are with you? Enough. Enough, you say? I wonder. He waved a hand. Never you mind me. My tongue runs a league before my own common sense, or so my father used to tell me. My first mate, Torson, is at the Chandler's now, overseeing the purchase of goods and equipment. I understand you have feed for your livestock? Among other things. Then you'd best fetch him. We can load him into the holds once the masts are up. Throughout the rest of the morning and afternoon, Roran and the villagers with him laboured to ferry the supplies which Loring's sons had procured from the warehouse where it was stored into the sheds with the barges. As Roran trudged across the gangplank to the Edeline and lowered his bag of flour to the sailor waiting in the hold, Clovis observed, "Most of this taint feed, Stronghammer." "No," said Roran, "but it's needed." He was pleased that Clovis had the sense not to inquire further. When the last item had been stored away, Clovis beckoned to Roran. "You might as well go. Me and the boys will handle the rest. Just you remember to be at the docks 3 hours after dawn with every man Jack you promised me, or we'll lose the tide. We'll be there." Back in the foothills, Roran helped Elaine and the others prepare for departure. It did not take long, as they were accustomed to breaking camp each morning. Then he picked 12 men to accompany him to Narda the next day. They were all good fighters, but he asked the best, like Horst and Delwyn, to remain with the rest of the villagers in case soldiers found them, or the Razak returned. Once night fell, the two groups parted. Roran crouched on a boulder and watched Horst lead the column of people down through the foothills toward the cove where they would wait for the barges. Orval came up beside him and crossed his arms. "Do you think they'll be safe, Stronghammer?" Anxiety ran through his voice like a taut bowstring. Though he too was worried, Roran said, "I do. I'd bet you a barrel of cider that they'll still be asleep when we put ashore tomorrow. You can have the pleasure of waking up Nola. How does that sound?" Orval smiled at the mention of his wife and nodded, appearing reassured. "I hope I'm right." Roran remained on the boulder, hunched like a bleak gargoyle, until the dark line of villages vanished from his sight. They woke an hour before sunrise, when the sky had just begun to brighten with pale green and the damp night air numbed their fingers. Roran splashed his face with water and then outfitted himself with his bow and quiver, his ever-present hammer, one of Fisk's shields and one of Horst's spears. The others did likewise, with the addition of swords obtained during the skirmishes in Carvajal. Running as fast as they dared down the hummocky hills, the 13 men soon arrived at the road to Narda, and shortly after that, the town's main gate. To Roran's dismay, the same 2 soldiers who had troubled them earlier stood guard by the entrance. As before, the soldiers lowered their poleaxes to block the way.
"There'll be quite a bit more of you this time," observed the white-haired man. "And not all the same ones, either. Except for you."
He focused on Roran.
"I suppose you expect me to believe that the spear and shield be for pottery as well?"
"No. We've been hired by Clovis to protect his barges from attack on the way to Tirm."
"You? Mercenaries?" The soldiers burst out laughing.
You said you were tradesmen.
This pays better. The white-haired man scowled.
You lie. I tried my hand at being a gentleman of fortune once. I spent more nights hungry than not.
How large be your company of tradesmen, anyway? 7 yesterday and 12 today, 13 counting you. It seems too large for an expedition from a bunch of shopkeepers.
His eyes narrowed as he scrutinised Roran's face. You look familiar. What'd be your name, eh?
Stronghammer.
It wouldn't happen to be Roran, would...
Roran jabbed forward with his spear, catching the white-haired soldier in the throat. Scarlet blood fountained. Releasing the spear, Roran drew his hammer and twisted round as he blocked the second soldier's poleaxe with his shield. Swinging his hammer up and around, Roran crushed the man's helm. He stood panting between the two corpses.
Now I have killed 10.
Orval and the other men stared at Roran with shock. Unable to bear their gazes, Roran turned his back on them and gestured at the culvert that ran beneath the road.
Hide the bodies before anyone sees, he ordered, brusque and harsh.
As they hurried to obey, he examined the parapet on top of the wall for sentries. Fortunately, no one was visible there or in the street through the gate. He bent and pulled his spear free, wiping the blade clean on a tuft of grass.
Done, said Mandel, clambering out of the ditch.
Despite his beard, the young man appeared pale. Roran nodded, and steeling himself, faced his band.
Listen, we will walk to the docks at a quick but reasonable pace. We will not run. When the alarm is sounded, and someone may have heard the clash just now, act surprised and interested, but not afraid. Whatever you do, give people no reason to suspect us. The lives of your families and friends depend on it. If we are attacked, your only duty is to see the barges launched. Nothing else matters. Am I clear?
Aye, Stronghammer,
they answered. Then follow me.
As he strode through Narda, Roran felt so tense he feared he might snap and explode into 1,000 pieces.
What have I made of myself? He wondered.
He glanced from man to woman, child to man to dog, in an effort to identify potential enemies. Everything around him appeared unnaturally bright and filled with detail. It seemed as if he could see the individual threads in people's clothing. They reached the docks without incident, whereupon Clovis said,
You be early, Stronghammer. I like that in a man. It'll give us the opportunity to put things nice and shipshape before we head out.
Can we leave now? Asked Roran.
You should know better than that. Have to wait till the tide's finished coming in, so we do.
Clovis paused then, taking his first good look at the 13 of them, and said,
Why, what'd be the matter, Stronghammer? The lot of you look as if you saw the ghost of old Galbatorix himself.
Nothing a few hours of sea air won't cure, said Roran.
In his current state he could not smile, but he did let his features assume a more pleasant expression in order to reassure the captain. With a whistle, Clovis summoned two sailors from the boats. Both men were tanned the colour of hazelnuts.
"This'd be Torson, my first mate," said Clovis, indicating the man to his right.
Torson's bare shoulder was decorated with a coiled tattoo of a flying dragon.
"He'll be skipper of the Mary Bell. And this black dog is Flint. He's in command of the Edeline. While you are on board, their word is law, as is mine on the Red Boar. You'll answer to them and me, not Stronghammer. Well, give me a proper aye-aye if you heard me."
"Aye-aye," said the men.
Now which of you be my hands and which be my men-at-arms? For the life of me, I can't tell you apart.
Ignoring Clovis's admonishment that he was their commander, not Roran, the villagers looked at Roran to see if they should obey. He nodded his approval, and they divided into two factions, which Clovis proceeded to partition into even smaller groups, as he assigned a certain number of villagers to each barge. For the next half hour, Roran worked alongside the sailors to finish preparing the Red Boar for departure, ears open for the first hint of alarm.
We're going to be captured or killed if we stay much longer, he thought, checking the height of the water against the piers.
He mopped sweat from his brow. Roran started as Clovis gripped his forearm. Before he could stop himself, Roran pulled his hammer halfway out of his belt. The thick air clogged his throat. Clovis raised an eyebrow at his reaction.
I've been watching you, Stronghammer, and I'd be interested to know how you won such loyalty from your men. I've served with more captains than I care to recall, and not one commanded the level of obedience you do without raising his pipes. Roran could not help it. He laughed. I'll tell you how I did it. I saved them from slavery and from being eaten. Clovis's eyebrows rose almost to his hairline. Did you know? There's a story I'd like to hear. No, you wouldn't. After a minute, Clovis said, No, maybe I wouldn't at that. He glanced overboard. Why, I'll be hanged. I do believe we can be on our way. Ah, and here's my little Galena, punctual as ever. The burly man sprang onto the gangplank, and from there onto the docks, where he embraced a dark-haired girl of perhaps 13, and a woman who Roran guessed was her mother. Clovis ruffled the girl's hair and said, Now you'll be good while I'm gone, won't you, Galena?
Yes, father.
As he watched Clovis bid his family farewell, Roran thought of the two soldiers dead by the gate. They might have had families as well, wives and children who loved them, and a home they returned to each day. He tasted bile, and had to wrench his thoughts back to the pier to avoid being sick. On the barges, the men appeared anxious. Afraid that they might lose their nerve, Roran made a show of walking about the deck, stretching, and doing whatever he could to seem relaxed. At last, Clovis jumped back onto the red boar and cried,
Cast off, me lads! It's the briny deep for us!
In short order, the gangplanks were pulled aboard, the mooring ropes untied and the sails raised on the three barges. The air rang with shouted orders and chants of heave-ho as the sailors pulled on ropes. Behind them, Galena and her mother remained watching as the barges drew away, still and silent, hooded and grave.
We're lucky, Stronghammer, said Clovis, clapping him on the shoulder. We've a bit of wind to push us along today. We may not have to row in order to reach the cove before the tide changes, eh?
When the Red Boar was in the middle of Narda's Bay, and still 10 minutes from the freedom of the open sea, that which Roran dreaded occurred. The sound of bells and trumpets floated across the water from among the stone buildings. What's that? He asked.
I don't rightly know, said Clovis.
He frowned as he stared at the town, his hands planted on his hips. It could be a fire, but no smoke is in the air.
Maybe some Urgles were discovered in the area.
Concern grew upon his face.
Did you perchance spy anyone on the road this morning?
Roran shook his head, not trusting himself to speak. Flint drew alongside them and shouted from the deck of the Edderline,
Should we turn back, sir?
Roran gripped the gunwale so hard that he drove splinters under his nails, ready to intercede, but afraid to appear too anxious. Tearing his gaze from Narda, Clovis bellowed in return.
No, we'd miss the tide then.
Aye, aye, sir, but I'd give a day's pay to find out what caused that clamour.
So would I, muttered Clovis.
As the houses and buildings shrank behind them, Roran crouched at the rear port of the barge, wrapped his arms around his knees, and leaned against the cabins. He looked at the sky, struck by its depth, clarity and colour, then into the Red Boar's roiling green wake, where ribbons of seaweed fluttered. The pitch of the barge lulled him like the rock of a cradle. What a beautiful day it is, he thought, grateful he was there to observe it. After they escaped the cove, to his relief, Roran climbed the ladder to the poop deck behind the cabins, where Clovis stood with his hand on the tiller, guiding their course. The captain said,
Ah, there's something exhilarating about the first day of a voyage, before you realise how bad the food is and start longing for home.
Mindful of his need to learn what he could about the barge, Roran asked Clovis the names and functions of various objects on board, at which point he was treated to an enthusiastic lecture on the workings of barges, ships, and the art of sailing in general. 2 hours later, Clovis pointed at a narrow peninsula that lay before them.
The cove be on the far side of that.
Roran straightened off the railing and craned his neck, eager to confirm that the villagers were safe. As the Red Boar rounded the rocky spit of land, a white beach was revealed at the apex of the cove, upon which were assembled the refugees from Palancar Valley.
The crowd cheered and waved as the barges emerged from behind the rocks. Roran relaxed. Beside him, Clovis uttered a dreadful oath.
"I knew something were amiss the moment I clapped eyes upon you, Stronghammer. Livestock, indeed. Bah, you played me like a fool, you did."
"You wrong me," replied Roran. "I did not lie. This is my flock, and I am their shepherd. Is it not within my right to call them livestock if I want?"
"Call them what you will. I didn't agree to haul people to Tirm. Why you didn't tell me the true nature of your cargo, I might wonder. And the only answer on the horizon is that whatever venture you're engaged in means trouble. Trouble for you and trouble for me. I should toss the lot of you overboard and return to Narda."
"But you won't," said Roran, deadly quiet.
"Oh, and why not?"
"Because I need these barges, Clovis, and I'll do anything to keep them. Anything. Honour our bargain and you'll have a peaceful trip, and you'll get to see Galena again. If not..." The threat sounded worse than it was. Roran had no intention of killing Clovis, though if he had to, he would abandon him somewhere along the coast. Clovis's face reddened, but he surprised Roran by grunting and saying,
"Fair enough, Stronghammer."
Pleased with himself, Roran returned his attention to the beach. Behind him, he heard a snick. Acting on instinct, Roran recoiled, crouching, twisting, and covering his head with his shield. His arm vibrated as a belaying pin broke across the shield. He lowered the shield and gazed at a dismayed Clovis, who retreated across the deck. Roran shook his head, never taking his eyes off his opponent. "You can't defeat me, Clovis. I'll ask you again. Will you honour our bargain? If you don't, I'll put you ashore, commandeer the barges, and press your crew into service. I don't want to ruin your livelihood, but I will if you force me. Come now. This can be a normal, uneventful voyage if you choose to help us. Remember, you've already been paid." Drawing himself up with great dignity, Clovis said,
"If I agree, then you must do me the courtesy of explaining why this ruse was necessary, and why these people are here, and where they're from. No matter how much gold you offer me, I won't assist an undertaking that contradicts my principles. No, I won't. Are you bandits, or do you serve the blasted king?"
"The knowledge may place you in greater danger."
"I insist."
"Have you heard of Carvajal in Palancar Valley?" asked Roran. Clovis waved a hand.
"Once or twice. What of it?"
"You see it now on the beach. Galbatorix's soldiers attacked us without provocation. We fought back, and when our position became untenable, we crossed the spine and followed the coast to Narda. Galbatorix has promised that every man, woman and child from Carvajal will be killed or enslaved. Reaching Sirda is our only hope of survival." Roran left out mention of the Razak. He did not want to frighten Clovis too badly. The weathered seaman had gone grey.
"Are you still pursued?"
"Aye, but the Empire has yet to discover us."
"And are you why the alarm was sounded?"
Very softly, Roran said, "I killed two soldiers who recognised me." The revelation startled Clovis. His eyes widened, he stepped back, and the muscles in his forearms rippled as he clenched his fists. "Make your choice, Clovis. The shore draws near." He knew he had won when the captain's shoulders drooped and the bravado faded from his bearing.
"Ah, the plague take you, Stronghammer. I'm no friend of the king. I'll get you to Tirm, but then I want nothing more to do with you."
"Will you give me your word that you won't attempt to slip away in the night or any similar deception?"
"Aye, you have it."
Sand and rocks grated across the bottom of the Red Boar's hull as the barge drove itself up onto the beach, followed on either side by its two companions. The relentless, rhythmic surge of water dashing itself against the land sounded like the breathing of a gigantic monster. Once the sails were furled and the gangplanks extended, Torson and Flint both strode over to the Red Boar and accosted Clovis, demanding to know what was going on.
"There's been a change of plans," said Clovis.
Roran left him to explain the situation, skirting the exact reasons why the villagers left Palancar Valley, and jumped onto the sand, whereupon he set out to find Horst among the milling knots of people. When he spotted the smith, Roran pulled him aside and told him about the deaths in Narda.
"If it's discovered that I left with Clovis, they may send soldiers on horses after us. We have to get everyone onto the barges as fast as possible."
Horst met his eye for a long minute.
"You've become a hard man, Roran. Harder than I'll ever be."
"I've had to."
"Mind that you don't forget who you are."
Roran spent the next 3 hours moving and packing the villagers' belongings in the Red Boar until Clovis expressed his satisfaction. The bundles had to be secured so that they would not shift unexpectedly and injure someone, as well as distributed so that the barge rode level in the water, which was no easy task, as the bundles were of irregular size and density. Then the animals were coaxed on board, much to their displeasure, and immobilized by tethers lashed to iron rings in the hold. Last of all came the people, who, like the rest of the cargo, had to be organized into a symmetrical pattern within the barge to keep from capsizing it. Clovis, Torson, and Flint each ended up standing in the fore of their barges, shouting directions to the mass of villagers below.
"What now?"
thought Roran as he heard an argument break out on the beach. Pushing his way to the source of the disturbance, he saw Kalitha kneeling beside her stepfather, Wayland, trying to calm the old man.
"No, I won't go on that beast. You can't make me,"
cried Wayland. He thrashed his withered arms and beat his heels in an attempt to free himself from Kalitha's embrace. Spittle flew from his lips.
"Let me go, I say, let me go."
Wincing from his blows, Kalitha said,
"He's been unreasonable ever since we made camp last night."
It would have been better for all concerned if he had died in the spine, what with the trouble he's caused, thought Roran. He joined Kalitha, and together they managed to soothe Wayland, so that he no longer screamed and hit. As a reward for his good behaviour, Kalitha gave him a piece of jerky, which occupied his entire attention. While Wayland concentrated on gumming the meat, she and Roran were able to guide him onto the Edeline and get him settled in a deserted corner where he would not be a nuisance.
"Move your backsides, you lubbers!" shouted Clovis. "The tide's about to turn. Hop to, hop to!"
After a final flurry of activity, the gangplanks were withdrawn, leaving a cluster of 20 men standing on the beach before each barge. The three groups gathered around the prows and prepared to push them back into the water. Roran led the effort on the Red Boar. Chanting in unison, he and his men strained against the weight of the huge barge, the grey sand giving beneath their feet, the timbers and cables creaking, and the smell of sweat in the air. For a moment their efforts seemed to be in vain. Then the Red Boar lurched and slid back a foot.
"Again!"
shouted Roran. Foot by foot they advanced into the sea until the frigid water surged about their waists. A breaker crashed over Roran, filling his mouth with seawater, which he spat out vigorously, disgusted by the taste of salt. It was far more intense than he expected. When the barge lifted free of the seabed, Roran swam alongside the Red Boar and pulled himself up with one of the ropes draped over the gunwale. Meanwhile, the sailors deployed long poles that they used to propel the Red Boar into ever deeper water, as did the crews of the Merrybell and Edeline. The instant they were a reasonable distance from shore, Clovis ordered the pole stowed away and oars broken out, with which the sailors aimed the Red Boar's prow toward the cove's entrance. They hoisted the sail, aligned it to catch the light wind, and at the vanguard of the trio of barges, set forth from Tirm upon the uncertain expanse of the bounding main.
The Beginning of Wisdom. The days Eragon spent in Ellesmere blended together without distinction. Time seemed to have no hold in the Pinewood City. The season aged not, even as the afternoons and evenings lengthened, barring the forest with rich shadows. Flowers of all months bloomed at the urging of the Elves' magic, nourished by the enchantments spun through the air. Eragon came to love Ellesmere, with its beauty and its quiet, the graceful buildings that flowed out of the trees, the haunting songs that echoed at twilight, the works of art hidden within the mysterious dwellings, and the introspection of the elves themselves, which they mixed with outbursts of merriment. The wild animals of Duweldenwaarden had no fear of hunters. Often Aragorn would look from his eyrie to see an elf petting a stag or a grey fox, or murmuring to a shy bear that trundled along the edge of a clearing, reluctant to expose himself. Some animals had no recognisable form. They appeared at night, moving and grunting in the bushes and fleeing if Aragorn dared approach. Once he glimpsed a creature like a furred snake, and once a white-robed woman whose body wavered and disappeared to reveal a grinning she-wolf in her place. Aragorn and Saphira continued to explore Ellesmere when they had the chance. They went alone or with Oric, for Arya no longer accompanied them, nor had Aragorn spoken to her since she broke his faith. He saw her now and then, flitting between the trees, but whenever he approached, intending to apologize, she withdrew, leaving him alone among the ancient pines. At last, Aragorn realized that he had to take the initiative if he were to ever have a chance of mending his relationship with her. So one evening, he picked a bouquet from the flowers along the path by his tree and hobbled to Teal Dari Hall, where he asked directions to Arya's quarters from an elf in the common room. The screen door was open when he reached her chambers. No one answered when he knocked. He stepped inside, listening for approaching footsteps as he glanced around the spacious, vine-covered living room, which opened to a small bedroom on one side and a study on the other. Two faiths decorated the walls, a portrait of a stern, proud elf with silver hair who Aragorn guessed was King Evandar, and that of a younger male elf whom he did not recognize. Aragorn wandered through the apartment, looking but not touching, savoring his glimpse into Arya's life, gleaning what he could about her interests and hobbies. By her bed, he saw a glass sphere with a preserved blossom of the black morning glory embedded within it. On her desk, neat rows of scrolls with titles like Ocylon, Harvest Report, and Activity Noted by Gilead Watchtower. On the sill of an open bay window, three miniature trees grown in the shape of glyphs from the ancient language, the glyphs for peace, strength, and wisdom. And by the trees, a scrap of paper with an unfinished poem, covered with crossed-out words and scribble marks. It read, "Under the moon, the bright white moon, lies a pool, a flat silver pool, among the brakes and brambles and blackheart pines. Falls a stone, a living stone, cracks the moon, the bright white moon, among the brakes and brambles and blackheart pines. Shards of light, swords of light, ripple across the pool. The quiet mere, the still tarn, the lonely lake there. In the night, the dark and heavy night, flutter shadows, confused shadows, where once..." Going to the small table by the entrance, Aragorn laid his bouquet upon it and turned to leave. He froze as he saw Arya standing in the doorway. She looked startled by his presence, then concealed her emotions behind an impassive expression. They stared at each other in silence. He lifted the bouquet, half offering it to her. "I don't know how to make a blossom for you like Faelin did, but these are honest flowers, and the best I could find."
"I cannot accept them, Aragorn.
They're not that sort of gift." He paused. "It's no excuse. But I didn't realize beforehand that my faith would put you in such a difficult situation. For that, I'm sorry, and I cry your pardon. I was just trying to make a faith, not cause trouble. I understand the importance of my studies, Arya, and you needn't fear I will neglect them in order to moon after you." He swayed and leaned against the wall, too dizzy to remain on his feet without support. "That's all." She regarded him for a long moment, then slowly reached out and took the bouquet, which she held beneath her nose. Her eyes never left his.
"They are honest flowers," she conceded.
Her gaze flickered down to his feet and back up again.
"Have you been ill?"
"No. My back..."
"I had heard, but I did not think..."
He pushed himself away from the wall. "I should go."
"Wait."
Arya hesitated, then guided him to the bay window, where he sat on the padded bench that curved from the wall. Removing two goblets from a cupboard, Arya crumbled dried nettle leaves into them, then filled the goblets with water and saying, "Boil." heated the water for tea. She gave a goblet to Aragorn, who held it with both hands so the warmth seeped into him. He glanced out the window to the ground 20 feet below, where elves walked among the royal gardens, talking and singing, and fireflies floated through the dusky air. "I wish," said Aragorn, "I wish it could always be like this. It's so perfect and quiet." Arya stirred her tea.
"How fares Saphira?"
"The same. And you?"
"I have been preparing to return to the Varden."
Alarm shot through him. "When?"
"After the Blood Oath celebration. I have tarried here far too long as it is, but I have been loath to leave, and Islanzadi wished me to stay. Also, I have never attended a Blood Oath celebration, and it is the most important of our observances."
She considered him over the rim of her goblet.
"Is there nothing Oromus can do for you?"
Aragorn forced a weary shrug.
"He tried everything he knows."
They sipped their tea and watched the groups and couples meander along the garden paths.
"Your studies go well, though?"
she asked. "They do." In the lull that followed, Aragorn picked up the scrap of paper from between the trees and examined her stanzas, as if reading them for the first time.
"Do you often write poetry?"
Arya extended her hand for the paper, and when he gave it to her, rolled it into a tube, so that the words were no longer visible.
"It is custom that everyone who attends the Blood Oath celebration should bring a poem, a song, or some other piece of art that they have made, and share it with those assembled. I have but begun to work on mine."
"I think it's quite good."
"If you had read much poetry..."
"I have." Arya paused, then dipped her head and said,
"Forgive me. You are not the person I first met in Gilead."
"No. I..." He stopped and twisted the goblet between his hands while he searched for the right words.
"Arya, you'll be leaving soon enough. I would count it a shame if this is the last I see of you between now and then. Could we not meet occasionally, as we did before, and you could show Saphira and me more of Ellesmere?" "It would not be wise," she said in a gentle but firm voice.
He looked up at her.
"Must the price of my indiscretion be our friendship? I cannot help how I feel toward you, but I would rather suffer another wound from Durza than allow my foolishness to destroy the companionship that existed between us. I value it too highly."
Lifting her goblet, Arya finished the last of her tea before responding.
"Our friendship shall endure, Aragorn. As for us spending time together..."
Her lips curved with a hint of a smile.
"Perhaps. However, we shall have to wait and see what the future brings, for I am busy and can promise nothing."
He knew her words were the closest thing to a conciliation he was likely to receive, and he was grateful for them.
"Of course, Arya Svitkona," he said, and bowed his head.
They exchanged a few more pleasantries, but it was clear that Arya had gone as far as she was willing to go that day. So Aragorn returned to Saphira, his hope restored by what he had accomplished.
"Now it's up to fate to decide the outcome," he thought,
as he settled before Oromus's latest scroll. Reaching into the pouch at his belt, Aragorn withdrew a soapstone container of Nalgask, beeswax melted with hazelnut oil, and smeared it over his lips to protect them against the cold wind that scoured his face. He closed the pouch, then wrapped his arms around Saphira's neck and buried his face in the crook of his elbow to reduce the glare from the wimpled clouds beneath them. The tireless beat of Saphira's wings dominated his hearing, higher and faster than those of Gleydas, whom she followed. They flew southwest from dawn until early afternoon, often pausing for enthusiastic sparring bouts between Saphira and Gleyda, during which Aragorn had to strap his arms onto the saddle to prevent himself from being thrown off by the stomach-turning acrobatics. He then would free himself by pulling on slipknots with his teeth. The trip ended at a cluster of 4 mountains that towered over the forest, the first mountains Aragorn had seen in Dwemeldenvarden. White-capped and windswept, they pierced the veil of clouds and bared their crevassed brows to the beating sun, which was heatless at such altitude.
"They look so small compared to the Beors," said Saphira.
As had become his habit during weeks of meditation, Eragon extended his mind in every direction, touching upon the consciousnesses around him, in search of any who might mean him harm. He felt a marmot warm in her burrow, ravens, nuthatches and hawks, numerous squirrels running among the trees, and farther down the mountain, rock snakes undulating through the brush in search of the mice that were their prey, as well as the hordes of ubiquitous insects. When Glada descended to a bare ridge on the first mountain, Saphira had to wait until he folded his massive wings before there was enough room for her to land. The field of boulder-strewn talus they alighted upon was brilliant yellow from a coating of hard, crenulated lichen. Above them loomed a sheer, black cliff. It acted as buttress and dam for a cornice of blue ice that groaned and split under the wind, loosing jagged slabs that shattered on the granite below.
"This peak is known as Fionnuala," said Glada, "and her brothers are Ethrundr, Meregovan, and Grimmensmal. Each has its own tale, which I shall recount on the flight back. But for now, I shall address the purpose of this trip, namely the nature of the bond forged between dragons and elves, and later, humans. You both know something of it, and I have hinted at its full implications to Saphira. But the time has come to learn the solemn and profound meaning of your partnership, so that you may uphold it when Oromis and I are no more."
"Master?" asked Eragon, wrapping his cloak around himself to stay warm.
"Yes, Eragon."
"Why is Oromis not here with us?"
"Because,"
rumbled Glada,
"it is my duty, as was always the duty of an elder dragon in centuries past, to ensure that the newest generation of riders understands the true importance of the station they have assumed. And because Oromis is not as well as he appears."
The rocks cracked with muffled reports as Glada coiled up, nestling himself among the scree and placing his majestic head upon the ground, lengthwise to Eragon and Saphira. He examined them with one gold eye as large as a polished round shield and twice as brilliant. A grey smudge of smoke drifted from his nostrils and was blown to tatters by the wind.
"Parts of what I am about to reveal were common knowledge among the elves, riders, and learned humans, but much of it was known only to the leader of the riders, a mere handful of elves, the human's current potentate, and, of course, the dragons. Listen now, my hatchlings. When peace was made between dragons and elves at the end of our war, the riders were created to ensure that such conflict would never again arise between our two races. Queen Tar-Munora of the elves and the dragon who had been selected to represent us, whose name..."
He paused and conveyed a series of impressions to Eragon. Long tooth, white tooth, chipped tooth, fights won, fights lost, countless eaten Shurg and Nagra. 27 eggs sired, and 19 offspring grown to maturity.
"Cannot be expressed in any language. Decided that a common treaty would not suffice. Signed paper means nothing to a dragon. Our blood runs hot and thick, and given enough time, it was inevitable that we would clash with the elves again, as we had with the dwarves over the millennia. But unlike with the dwarves, neither we nor the elves could afford another war. We were both too powerful, and we would have destroyed each other. The one way to prevent that and to forge a meaningful accord was to link our two races with magic."
Eragon shivered, and with a touch of amusement, Glada said,
"Saphira, if you are wise, you will heat one of these rocks with the fire from your belly, so that your rider does not freeze."
Thereupon Saphira arched her neck, and a jet of blue flame emanated from between her serrated fangs and splashed against the scree, blackening the lichen, which released a bitter smell as it burned. The air grew so hot that Aragorn was forced to turn away. He felt the insects underneath the rocks were being crisped in the inferno. After a minute, Saphira clapped shut her jaws, leaving a circle of stones 5 feet across, glowing cherry red.
"Thank you," Aragorn said to her. He hunched by the edge of the scorched rocks and warmed his hands over them.
"Remember, Saphira, to use your tongue to direct the stream,"
admonished Gleda.
"Now, it took 9 years for the elves' wisest magicians to devise the needed spell. When they had, they and the dragons gathered together at Illyria. The elves provided the structure of the enchantment, the dragons provided the strength, and together they melded the souls of elves and dragons. The joining changed us. We dragons gained the use of language and other trappings of civilization, while the elves shared in our longevity, since before that moment their lives were as short as humans. In the end, the elves were the most affected. Our magic, dragon's magic, which permeates every fiber of our being, was transmitted to the elves, and in time gave them their much-vaunted strength and grace. Humans have never been influenced as strongly since you were added to the spell after its completion, and it has not had as much time to work upon you as with the elves. Still,"
and here Gleda's eye gleamed,
"it has already gentled your race from the rough barbarians who first landed in Alagazia, though you have begun to regress since the fall."
"Were dwarves ever part of this spell?" asked Aragorn.
"No, and that is why there has never been a dwarf rider. They do not care for dragons, nor we for them, and they found the idea of being joined with us repellent. Perhaps it is fortunate that they did not enter into our pact, for they have escaped the decline of humans and elves."
"Decline, master?"
queried Saphira, in what Aragorn would have sworn was a teasing tone of voice.
"Aye, decline. If one or another of our three races suffer, so do they all. By killing dragons, Galbatorix harmed his own race as well as the elves. The two of you have not seen this, for you are new to Ellesmere. But the elves are on the wane. Their power is not what it once was. And humans have lost much of their culture and been consumed by chaos and corruption. Only by righting the imbalance between our three races shall order return to the world."
The old dragon kneaded the scree with his talons, crumbling it into gravel so that he was more comfortable.
"Layered within the enchantment Queen Tar-Munura oversaw was the mechanism that allows a hatchling to be linked with his or her rider. When a dragon decides to give an egg to the riders, certain words are said over the egg, which I shall teach you later, that prevent the dragon inside from hatching until it is brought into contact with the person with whom it decides to bond. As dragons can remain in their eggs indefinitely, time is of no concern, nor is the infant harmed. You yourself are an example of this, Saphira. The bond that forms between a rider and dragon is but an enhanced version of the bond that already exists between our races. the human or elf becomes stronger and fairer, while some of the dragon's fiercer traits are tempered by a more reasoned outlook. I see a thought biting at your tongue, Aragorn. What is it?
It's just... He hesitated. I have a hard time imagining you or Saphira being any fiercer. Not, he added anxiously, that that's a bad thing. The ground shook as if with an avalanche, as Glaedah chuckled, rolling his great big staring eye behind its horny lid and back again.
If ever you met an unbonded dragon, you would not say so. A dragon alone answers to no one and no thing, takes whatever pleases it, and bears no thought of kindness for aught but its kith and kin. Fierce and proud were the wild dragons, even arrogant. The females were so formidable, it was accounted a great accomplishment among the rider's dragons to mate with one. The lack of this bond is why Galbatorix's partnership with Shlooken, his second dragon, is such a perverted union. Shlooken did not choose Galbatorix as his partner. He was twisted by certain black magics into serving Galbatorix's madness. Galbatorix has constructed a depraved imitation of the relationship that you, Aragorn, and you, Saphira, possess, and that he lost when the Urgals murdered his original dragon.
Glaedah paused and looked between the two of them. His eye was all that moved.
That which links you exceeds any simple connection between minds. Your very souls, your identities, call it what you will, have been welded on a primal level.
His eye flicked to Aragorn.
Do you believe that a person's soul is separate from his body?
I don't know, said Aragorn. Saphira once took me out of my body and let me see the world through her eyes. It seemed like I was no longer connected to my body. And if the wraiths that a sorcerer calls upon can exist, then maybe our consciousness is independent of flesh as well. Extending the needle-sharp tip of his foreclaw, Glaedah flipped over a rock to expose a wood rat cowering in its nest. He snapped up the rat with a flash of his red tongue. Aragorn winced as he felt the animal's life extinguished.
When the flesh is destroyed, so is the soul, said Glaedah.
But an animal isn't a person, protested Aragorn.
After your meditations, do you truly believe that any of us are so different from a wood rat? That we are gifted with a miraculous quality that other creatures do not enjoy, and that somehow preserves our beings after death?
No, muttered Aragorn.
I thought not. Because we are so closely joined, when a dragon or rider is injured, they must harden their hearts and sever the connection between them in order to protect each other from unnecessary suffering, even insanity. And since the soul cannot be torn from the flesh, you must resist the temptation to try to take your partner's soul into your own body and shelter it there, as that will result in both your deaths. Even if it were possible, it would be an abomination to have multiple consciousnesses in one body.
How terrible, said Aragorn, to die alone, separate even from the one who is closest to you.
Everyone dies alone, Aragorn. Whether you are a king on a battlefield or a lowly peasant lying in bed among your family, no one can accompany you into the void. Now I will have you practice separating your consciousnesses. Start by...
Aragorn stared at the tray of dinner left in the anteroom of the treehouse. He catalogued the contents. bread with hazelnut butter, berries, beans, a bowl of leafy greens, 2 hard-boiled eggs, which in accordance with the elves' beliefs were unfertilized, and a stoppered jug of fresh spring water. He knew that each dish was prepared with the utmost care, that the elves lavished all of their culinary skills upon his meals, and that not even Islan Zardi ate better than him. He could not bear the sight of the tray.
"I want meat," he growled, stomping back into the bedroom.
Safira looked up at him from her dais.
"I'd even settle for fish or fowl, anything besides this never-ending stream of vegetables. They don't fill up my stomach. I'm not a horse. Why should I be fed like one?"
Safira unfolded her legs, walked to the edge of the teardrop gap overlooking Ellesmira, and said,
"I have needed to eat these past few days. Would you like to join me? You can cook as much meat as you like, and the elves will never know."
"That I would," he said, brightening. "Should I get the saddle?"
"We won't go that far."
Aragorn fetched his supply of salt, herbs and other seasonings from his bags, and then, careful not to overexert himself, climbed into the gap between the spikes along Saphira's spine. Launching herself off the ground, Saphira let an updraft waft her high above the city, whereupon she glided off the column of warm air, slipping down and sideways as she followed a braided stream through Dueldenvarden to a pond some miles thence. She landed and hunched low to the ground, making it easier for Aragorn to dismount. She said,
"There are rabbits in the grass by the edge of the water. See if you can catch them. In the meantime, I go to hunt deer."
"What, you don't want to share your own prey?"
"No, I don't,"
she replied grumpily.
"Though I will, if those oversized mice elude you."
He grinned as she took off, then faced the tangled clumps of grass and cow parsnip that surrounded the pond, and set about procuring his dinner. Less than a minute later, Aragorn collected a brace of dead rabbits from their nest. It had taken him but an instant to locate the rabbits with his mind, and then kill them with one of the 12 death words. What he had learned from Oromis had drained the challenge and excitement from the chase.
"I didn't even have to stalk them,"
he thought, remembering the years he had spent honing his tracking abilities. He grimaced with sour amusement.
"I can finally bag any game I want, and it seems meaningless to me. At least when I hunted with a pebble with Brom, it was still a challenge. But this is slaughter."
The warning of the sword-shaper Runan returned to him then.
"When you can have anything you want by uttering a few words, the goal matters not, only the journey to it."
"I should have paid more attention to her," realized Aragorn.
With practiced movements, he drew his old hunting knife, skinned and gutted the rabbits, and then, putting aside the hearts, lungs, kidneys and livers, buried the viscera so that the scent would not attract scavengers. Next, he dug a pit, filled it with wood, and lit a small blaze with magic, since he had not thought to bring his flint and steel. He tended the fire until he had a bed of coals. Cutting a wand of dogwood, he stripped the bark and seared the wood over the coals to burn off the bitter sap, then spitted the carcasses on the wand and suspended them between 2 forked branches, pounded into the ground. For the organs, he placed a flat stone upon a section of the coals and greased it with fat for a makeshift frying pan. Saphira found him crouched by the fire, slowly turning the wand to cook the meat evenly. She landed with a limp deer hanging from her jaws and the remains of a second deer clutched in her talons. Measuring her length out in the fragrant grass, she proceeded to gorge upon her prey, eating the entire deer, including the hide. Bones cracked between her razor teeth like branches snapping in a gale. When the rabbits were ready, Aragorn waved them in the air to cool them, then stared at the glistening golden meat, the smell of which he found almost unbearably enticing. As he opened his mouth to take the first bite, his thoughts turned unbidden to his meditations. He remembered his excursions into the minds of birds and squirrels and mice, how full of energy they felt, and how vigorously they fought for the right to exist in the face of danger. "And if this life is all they have..." Gripped by revulsion, Aragorn thrust the meat away, as appalled by the fact that he had killed the rabbits as if he had murdered 2 people. His stomach churned and threatened to make him purge himself. Saphira paused in her feast to eye him with concern. Taking a long breath, Eragon pressed his fists against his knees in an attempt to master himself and understand why he was so strongly affected. His entire life he had eaten meat, fish, and fowl. He enjoyed it. And yet it now made him physically ill to consider dining upon the rabbits. He looked at Saphira. "I can't do it," he said.
"It is the way of the world that everything eats everything else. Why do you resist the order of things?"
He pondered her question. He did not condemn those who did partake of flesh. He knew that it was the only means of survival for many a poor farmer. But he could no longer do so himself, unless faced with starvation. Having been inside of a rabbit, and having felt what a rabbit feels, eating one would be akin to eating himself.
"Because we can better ourselves," he answered Saphira. "Should we give in to our impulses to hurt or kill any who anger us? To take whatever we want from those who are weaker, and in general, to disregard the feelings of others? We are made imperfect, and we must guard against our flaws lest they destroy us." He gestured at the rabbits. As Oromis said, "Why should we cause unnecessary suffering?"
"Would you deny all of your desires, then?"
"I would deny those that are destructive."
"You are adamant on this?"
"Aye."
"In that case,"
said Saphira, advancing upon him,
"these will make a fine dessert."
In a blink, she gulped down the rabbits and then licked clean the stone with the organs, abrading the slate with the barbs on her tongue.
"I, at least, cannot live on plants alone. That is food for prey, not a dragon. I refuse to be ashamed about how I must sustain myself. Everything has its place in the world. Even a rabbit knows that."
"I'm not trying to make you feel guilty," he said, patting her on the leg. "This is a personal decision. I won't force my choice upon anyone."
"Very wise,"
she said, with a touch of sarcasm. Broken Egg and Scattered Nest.
"Concentrate, Eragon," said Oromis, though not unkindly.
Eragon blinked and rubbed his eyes in an attempt to focus on the glyphs that decorated the curling parchment paper before him.
"Sorry, Master."
Weariness dragged upon him like lead weights tied to his limbs. He squinted at the curved and spiked glyphs, raised his goose-feather quill, and began to copy them again. Through the window behind Oromis, the green shelf on top of the crags of Telnair was streaked with shadows from the descending sun. Beyond, feathery clouds banded the sky. Eragon's hand jerked as a line of pain shot up his leg, and he broke the nib of the quill and sprayed ink across the paper, ruining it. Across from him, Oromis also started, clutching his right arm.
"Saphira!"
cried Eragon. He reached for her with his mind, and to his bewilderment was deflected by impenetrable barriers that she had erected around herself. He could barely feel her. It was as if he were trying to grasp an orb of polished granite, coated with oil. She kept slipping away from him. He looked at Oromis. "Something has happened to them, hasn't it?"
"I know not. Glader returns, but he refuses to talk to me."
Taking his blade, Nagling, from the wall, Oromis strode outside and stood upon the edge of the crags, head uplifted as he waited for the gold dragon to appear. Eragon joined him, thinking of everything, probable and improbable, that might have befallen Saphira. The two dragons had left at noon, flying north, to a place called the Stone of Broken Eggs, where the wild dragons had nested in ages past. It was an easy trip.
"It couldn't be Urgles. The elves don't allow them into Dueldumvarden," he told himself.
At last, Glader came into view high above as a winking speck among the darkening clouds. As he descended to land, Eragon saw a wound on the back of the dragon's right foreleg, a tear in his lapped scales as wide as Eragon's hand. Scarlet blood laced the grooves between the surrounding scales. The moment Glader touched the ground, Oromis rushed toward him, only to stop when the dragon growled at him. Hopping on his injured leg, Glader crawled to the edge of the forest where he curled up,
beneath the outstretched boughs, his back to Aragorn, and set about licking clean his wound. Aramis went and knelt in the clover by Gleda, keeping his distance with calm patience. It was